Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now, a Massachusetts congressman is under fire from conservative critics for bringing home the bacon, so to speak, for his constituents. That's because, on his own, Democrat Congressman William Delahunt brokered a deal with one of President Bush's staunchest critics, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Under the deal, Citgo, the U.S. subsidiary of a Venezuelan-owned oil company, will provide 12 million gallons of discounted home heating oil to low-income Massachusetts residents who qualify for the program. Delahunt first discussed the issue with Chavez during a private meeting in Caracas last August. The deal is being signed today, and Congressman Delahunt says it may eventually be extended to other states beyond Massachusetts. Congressman Delahunt joins us on the line. And Congressman, you're winning applause from your constituents here in Massachusetts. But what's your response to critics who are calling you an apologist for a man who's no friend of President Bush? Chavez has called the president a crazy man and an assassin.
Well, I'm certainly not an apologist for anyone. I speak for myself, and I represent the people here in Massachusetts. But let me say this. I'm very grateful for the response of the Venezuelan government and the fact that Citgo, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Venezuelan state oil company, is stepping up to the plate, so to speak. Other colleagues, both in the House and the Senate, have requested other oil companies, such as Exxon and Chevron, to do the same. But they were told that, that's a government problem, and they don't want to establish a precedent. But at least we've had some success here, and it will clearly alleviate a lot of the fears and concerns that people in Massachusetts have about being able to get through the winter without having to make choices between food and drug prescriptions and home heating oil.
Well,
so you feel good.
Well, you say that other companies have not wanted to do these sort of independent deals because that's a government, quote, problem. But some would say it's the job of the government, and then you're sort of interceding where the State Department should be doing the work.
Well, I don't think it's really the responsibility of the State Department, but it is the responsibility of the Congress and the administration, and they haven't done the job. We do have federal fuel assistance programs, but they're inadequately funded. What I find particularly ironic is that in the past several months, we've managed to provide over $16 billion for oil companies in the form of subsidies. So not only are we paying higher prices for our home heating oil, we're paying to subsidize oil companies that have made obscene profits. In one quarter, for example, Exxon, the profit was $10 billion. So let's call this a challenge to American oil companies to help people.
President Chavez has said he wants to help low-income people in the United States. Do you see this on his part as extending some sort of olive branch to the U.S., what some are calling petro-diplomacy? Or do you see it, perhaps as a chance to embarrass the president and, you're playing a part in that?
I don't need to embarrass President Bush, okay? This is about people. It's about a humanitarian gesture. Let's leave the politics aside. I noted back in September in the aftermath of Katrina that Senator Mel Martinez of Florida, a Republican that had the support of President Bush in the White House in his last campaign, said, "Why won't we accept Castro's offer to send doctors to the Gulf states?"
Well, we were reminded Chavez diverted gas to the U.S. too.
And he sent a check to the American Red Cross for $1 million. I mean, this is so much about silliness. And when it comes to democracy, the people in Venezuela give Chavez a favorable rating of 70%. And Bush, all over Latin America, gets a 81% negative rating. And the sample is taken from the elite not those that would be the natural constituencies of Hugo Chavez. So we've got a real problem that this administration doesn't want to address. And it's got nothing to do with Hugo Chavez. It's got to do with our policies in Latin America.
Democratic Congressman William Delahunt, he brokered a deal with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez that will provide 12 million gallons of discounted home heating oil to low-income Massachusetts residents. Congressman Delahunt, thanks for speaking with us about it.
Thank you, Robin. Have a good day.
It's November 22nd, a date that doesn't have the same breath-stopping power it once did, but a date that still resonates. And now there's another John Kennedy to remember on this day. And when John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane crashed en route to Martha's Vineyard in the summer of 1999, killing him, his wife Carolyn Bessette, and her sister Lauren, few Americans knew that there was another tragedy unspooling in that family. Waiting for Kennedy on Martha's Vineyard that night was John's cousin and best friend, Anthony Radziwill, and Anthony's wife, Carol, both of them television news producers. Anthony, the only son of Lee Radziwill, the nephew of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, was battling cancer. 3 weeks later, he too would be dead. Carol and Anthony Radziwill and John and Carolyn Kennedy were an inseparable foursome. Now there is just one. And Carol Radziwill has written a memoir called, fittingly, What Remains. And she joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
You write about your first impression when you met John. Can you remember that first impression?
My first impression of him was, and I think I'm not exactly sure how I wrote this in the book, but of entirety. You know, he was very self-possessed and very comfortable with himself. He always made everyone in the room feel comfortable. And he had this way of just kind of dismissing all of the formality that I think people felt when they met him for the first time.
And I ask you about John first because people feel they may know something about John mm-hmm. Kennedy. But it's by way of introducing Anthony to people because Anthony was less well-known. And they compare and contrast, don't they?
Yeah, well, they're like Oscar and Felix. John was a bit messy.
John was Oscar to Anthony's Felix.
Yeah, Anthony grew up in London at boarding school, so he was very structured and organized and very neat. And to see the two of them together, we shared a summer house for a few summers, and it was just hilarious.
What else about Anthony? Because, again, he's not as well-known and yet cherished.
He was, because I think he, like John in that way, was completely unassuming and unpretentious, and he was introduced to me just as Anthony, you know, and I didn't know the association immediately when I met him. It was later explained to me, as it always is, sort of counting backwards on the family tree, that he was the nephew of the president and cousin to John Kennedy.
Well, and you met when he was working in television, and
yeah.
Who were you in this picture?
Well, I was descended from a quite a different place. I was I grew up in a small working class town in a very big, loud Italian family. My parents worked hard, sometimes two jobs. We sort of lived paycheck to paycheck. But I think I had the kind of childhood most kids dream of, completely lawless and unruly and undisciplined. I think Anthony sometimes wished that he had grown up like me. But of course, the grass is always greener on the other side.
But we should rush to point out that you had mm-hmm. breathed some rarefied air in the news world in your own
yes.
life, on your own.
Mm-hmm.
As a producer for ABC, you traveled to
yes.
the Gulf to cover war.
Yes.
To Vietnam.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. To Vietnam, Cambodia to cover post-war. You are one of those absolutely cherished people behind the famous people in the news, Peter Jennings
yes.
being one that you worked for.
Yeah, I worked for Peter for the first 6 years at ABC News.
Yeah. Well, and as I said, it also, you know, you've had exposure to a lot of different things. But still, mm-hmm. what was it like to cross that, you know, real class culture border into American royalty when you're having lunch at the Radziwills once
right.
you start dating Anthony?
Lunch, I thought, and I think I wrote about this, was the great class divide, because lunch in the DeFalco household was really nothing more than like grabbing a sandwich, if there was a sandwich, mm-hmm. and running out the door, or you know, it was always like eating standing up. And then Anthony's mom had these very elegant Sunday summer lunches every weekend, and always invited who's who of New York business and society and fashion and politics. And so there was I was very intimidated in the beginning. And I think in the same way that Anthony sort of had to endure the DeFalco family barbecues and the endless, like, screaming fights over the Yankees pitching staff or whether the Jets were going to get into the Super Bowl that season, you know, there was a period of adjustment.
Yeah. Well, you and Anthony marry in a fairy tale wedding. And then enter Carolyn, John's beautiful girlfriend. Now, most Americans thought of her as born to privilege as well. But you discovered you both worked at Caldor's at one point.
Yes. She wasn't born to privilege. She was brought up by a single mom. Her father left the family when Carolyn was two. And we did, as we got to know each other, find out that we both worked at this department store. We used to joke with Anthony and John that when they were learning how to water ski off the Christina, we were stocking inventory and pricing diapers and stuff like that.
The Christina being the yacht, right, that belonged to...
Yes, they were spending their summers in the Greek islands, and we were a Caldor.
How did that work out, though? I mean, because you all struck this incredible fast friendship, the four of you. It was the four of you. And just was there any time where, you know, someone said, you mean you never heard of that wine? Or I mean, how did it...
No, I think they, John and Anthony, both really embraced that part of Carolyn and I. I think they saw both Carolyn and I as real people that were, you know, had similar values and you know, because we didn't come from their same world, they didn't care at all about that. There was never really a moment where any of us felt uncomfortable.
Mm. Towards the end, you write that Carolyn felt as if she'd lost her footing. John was having difficulty with his magazine, George. Of course, you were all dealing with Anthony's illness. I just want to ask you this, and to the extent that you feel comfortable, there's been a lot of speculation that John and his wife were actually having problems with their marriage. How would you characterize it?
I think what distorts so much in life is not people not understanding the difference between facts and the truth. And the fact was it was a very difficult summer. The fact was it wasn't the best time for John or for me or for Carolyn. The truth is that they loved each other and they respected each other and they had a good marriage under extraordinary circumstances. And I think part of what I did with this book, and not really intentionally because I was just writing about my friends, but, you know, I brought a little humanity to their lives. I mean, and in that way, you have to, when you're writing about real people and not the myth, you have to allow for imperfection and irony and humor and, you know, eating SpaghettiOs out of a can, you know, which is what Carol and I used to do a lot in the hospitals. And I think it's unfortunate that people feel free to sort of speculate about the state of a marriage or the state of a person after they're no longer here to defend themselves. That's not what I saw, and I spend a lot of time with them.
Well, as you say, eating SpaghettiOs in hospitals. Carol Radziwill and Carolyn Bessette Kennedy spent a lot of time together in hospitals as Anthony fought what turned out to be terminal cancer. Who would have thought it would be John and Carolyn who would die first? We'll hear much more from Carol Radziwill, including what happened that night when she and a dying Anthony waited on Martha's Vineyard for John and Carolyn to fly in and visit. And, of course, they never arrived. Carol's new book is called What Remains. Much more coming up here and now. And we want to hear more from Carol Radziwill, who's written a new memoir of her marriage to Anthony Radziwill and her friendship with Anthony's cousin, John Kennedy Jr., and John's wife, Carolyn. But first, a reading from Carol's new book, What Remains. In this scene, Carol and John's wife, Carolyn, are at the hospital bedside of Anthony, who is battling cancer. And Carol is relieved when John arrives from a formal event that he had to attend.
John comes back late that evening in his tuxedo, straight from an event. It's nearly midnight, and Carolyn and I are waiting for him. He's the one who can save us somehow, the one we count on. He kisses her, gives me a quick hug, and walks over to Anthony's bed. Tony Pro, he says quietly and grabs Anthony's hand. John's shoes are black and shiny. His bow tie is undone. His tuxedo looks comical in the yellow lights of the ICU. He begins humming, and then there are words. We can barely hear him. but Anthony does, and he smiles. And then his mouth starts to move along with John's. If you go down to the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down to the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. They sing together softly this children's song, with their hands clasped like little boys. They sing it over and over, John holding tightly onto Anthony's hand. They are in a place that no one else has ever been or could ever go, singing a song that John's mother used to sing to the two of them. The boys who laughed and played and sang silly songs are all grown up now. John in a tuxedo, Anthony in a hospital gown.
A reading from Carol Radziwill's new memoir, What Remains. And Carol, that's just a heartbreaking scene.
It was. I remember that night, and Carolyn and I were sitting in that room, the ICU, and the doctors really didn't think Anthony was going to make it. And there was kind of nothing left for us to do but sit and wait. Anthony was sort of drifting in and out of consciousness. And when he walked in and started singing this children's lullaby, it was heartbreaking, but it was also beautiful. And I remember Carolyn and I thinking that they were in a place that we could never access. And it was some place, you know, where there were shared memories and they've been through so much together as kids. It was quite awesome, actually, to watch it.
They were so close. I should say that, you know, I also knew Anthony from working in television. Mm-hmm. And anyone who knew him knew that he and John were the brothers that they didn't have. And I'm thinking, too, they were the only sons that their mothers had.
Yes.
It just makes it even more just horrific what ultimately happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and the cruelest of ironies is that Anthony had to see John die 3 weeks before his own death. I mean, you know, we thought somehow the four of us or the three of us thought we would sort of get a pass from anything bad happening. We had been taking care of Anthony and there was so much sadness that we just thought, okay, let's just hold our breath and we'll get through this. And there'll be a time, at least I thought, sometime in the future when we would look back, the three of us, and think about Anthony and laugh about the fun times that we had. And it was so hard for Anthony to see that happen. Mm-hmm. And then it was hard for me after Anthony died 3 weeks later.
And you didn't have John and Carolyn, as you had planned, to help you with it. I do want to take a second on that night, that horrific Friday night where your book begins and ends. Here the whole world was buzzing. I mean, as you know, all the news stations went immediately to coverage Saturday morning of John Kennedy's plane missing. And you were the one who first, well, there was a friend who called from Hyannis to say the plane hasn't come in.
But yeah, second, John's friend Pinky.
But then you were the one who realized, had a growing realization what you were dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as John's friend called at midnight to say that the plane hadn't arrived, you know, I instantly knew that it wasn't going to end well. But I kind of got into reporter mode a little bit. I just, you know, my training as a journalist, I think, helped me disconnect a little bit because I knew I had to make phone calls. I knew I had to try to find information about where they may have landed, if they landed somewhere else, or maybe perhaps they went back to New York. And it was about 2 hours of calling, you know, air traffic control in Logan and LaGuardia and all the regional airports around the area until about 2 o'clock, where I realized I had to call the Coast Guard and get help. You know, I couldn't do it on my own anymore.
And call mothers, sisters?
Yes. I think it was probably about 5 o'clock by the time I called. I didn't want to wake up Carolyn's mother in the middle of the night, so I thought if I'd waited to five. But I knew it was a call that I had to make because at the time I thought, well, maybe someone got wind of this and the news will have it in the morning. You know, it's odd because in my little world in the kitchen of John's house in the vineyard, you know, I didn't have a sense of whether or not this would be a news story or whether people even knew about it. You know, it was just me making calls, you know, to the Coast Guard and the Air Force and then to various airports. But I knew I had to call Carolyn's mom, and that was probably, you know, the most difficult call to make. And then Anthony called John's sister.
I wonder, Carol Radziwill, if that night or shortly after, you ever had the thought, this family is tinged with sadness, with glory? Mm-hmm. But with tragedy, I mean, did you feel as this was unfolding, oh my gosh, this is it, this is that thing they talk about? It. Did you feel it or not?
I didn't, and that's a valid question, though, and I've been asked it. You know, this was my husband and my best friend and cousin, and I don't think so much about any kind of Kennedy curse. I think that they've been blessed with a great many things, and like any large family, they have certainly their share, maybe more so, of tragedy and very public tragedy. And I don't think they go around thinking that they're cursed, or that's something that the press has talked about and writes about, these two-dimensional characters as mythic. The real people are way, way, way more interesting than anything that's really been written about them.
Carol Radziwill's new book, What Remains, tells of her life and her memories of her husband, Anthony Radziwill, his best friend and cousin, John Kennedy Jr., and John's wife, Carolyn Bessette Kennedy. Carol Radziwill, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
Teddy bear who's been good.
Funding for Here.
It's Here and Now. Journalists are still trying to parse the fallout from the news that Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward had a source in the Valerie Plame case. Last week, Woodward testified to Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald that he had learned the identity of Valerie Plame from a White House official 1 month before Robert Novak outed her in his column in July of 2003, and 10 days before Lewis Scooter Libby allegedly disclosed her identity to reporter Judith Miller. Fitzgerald had said Libby was the first White House official to disclose Valerie Plame's name. Now, Woodward never wrote Plame's name. He's said he didn't come forward earlier because he didn't want to be subpoenaed. And he's also apologized, calling his decision not to tell Washington Post editor Leonard Downey about his involvement in the case a mistake. But while the legal twists and turns of the investigation continue, Fitzgerald has now called for a new grand jury, Woodward's disclosure has caused quite a stir in newsrooms. Michael Massing is a contributing writer to the New York Review of Books. He's also author of the book Now They Tell Us, The American Press and Iraq. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Geneva Overholzer, who was the ombudsman at the Washington Post from 1995 to 1998. She's currently teaching at the Missouri School of Journalism's Washington Bureau. And Geneva, we welcome you as well.
Good to be with you.
And I want to start with you because the Post's current ombudsman, Deborah Howell, has been very critical of Woodward. What would you have written if you were still at the Post as ombudsman? What would you have said?
I definitely would have been at least as critical. I think Deborah did a fine job, but I would have finished with a stronger concern about whether or not Woodward can in fact serve these two masters, so to speak, the Post with its emphasis on daily journalism, and the books which he writes, which it seems to me are a very, very different thing.
And remind us, he's had a very unbelievable access to the White House, to this White House in particular.
Indeed.
For his books.
He has, and to the previous one. I mean, he's doing a very different thing, Robin, in my view, from what he was doing when he was at Watergate, where he was clearly an outsider reporter watchdogging those in power and using anonymous sources to do so, anonymous sources who really were whistleblowers. And now he's the ultimate insider with great access, and he does a remarkable job of conveying what those in power wish to say. But I think it's not daily journalism, a full and fair and comprehensive report in the public interest to be published in the newspaper. And I just think if I were the editor of the Post, I would not be comfortable with his continued employment as a journalist at the Post.
Well, that's pretty strong. Michael Massing, your thoughts, including what do you think the real journalistic sin here? Is it not telling his editor that he had a source and was involved in the case, or is it the fact that Woodward disparaged the investigation on NPR and elsewhere as it was going on, knowing that he had a role in it?
Yes. Geneva's raised interesting questions about Bob Woodward's career, and I could weigh in on that as well. But on the more immediate matter, I do not share the sense of outrage that he did not confide this earlier to his editor. I mean, the guy was clearly trying to protect his source and wanted to remain true to that. Clearly made a mistake, but the idea that it should be a capital offense, I don't really share. He clearly committed a major mistake by commenting on the investigation and disparaging it when he himself had a stake in it. That he himself has acknowledged was terribly wrong and does not make him look very good.
And Michael, I want to make sure we're clear. You say perhaps it wasn't a capital offense not to tell his editor, but should he have gone to Fitzgerald and tell the investigation?
Well, that's a hard call. I mean, the whole thing has been focusing on should he have come forward early or not. I guess he, in a way, did sort of give up the name without. I don't know. Did he in fact get a waiver from the source or not?
Well, Geneva, jump in on that. Woodward is now saying that even now he can't name the source because the source has not released him to do that.
Well, he called the source and noted that it was important that the source who decided to go to Fitzgerald do so. And the source told him that he gave Woodward a waiver and that Woodward should testify. So he did, but the source didn't allow Woodward to speak publicly about who he or she is. But no, I certainly don't think that Woodward should have volunteered the source to the press. If we come to a day where journalists are just sort of giving up sources voluntarily to prosecutors, then we're in real trouble. But I think it is outrageous he didn't tell his editor. It speaks to his not really being or operating according to the normal rules of a newsroom.
Well, he explained last night on Larry King why he feels he has to do that. Let's listen to a cut. Larry King has just asked Woodward if he has concerns about why this source continues to want to not be named publicly, as we just said. Woodward said he'd love to reveal the source, but the source has not given him permission. And he goes on to make the case that he's doing this for the public. Let's listen.
I've spent my life trying to find out what's really hidden, what's in the bottom of the barrel. To get what's in the bottom of the barrel, you have to establish relationships of confidentiality with people at all levels of government. You have to establish relationships of trust. And then those people will provide you with information and evidence so you can get to the better version, what Carl Bernstein and I used to call the best obtainable version of the truth.
Geneva Overholzer, I just want to ask you, this kind of thinking, is it raising questions in journalistic circles about which sources need protecting? In other words, is there, or do you think there should be a distinction between protecting a source who is a whistleblower who needs to be protected from power and protecting a source who is in power and presumably has other avenues to grind an axe?
I absolutely do, and I think you've put the right distinction. And again, I would say that in the first instance, we all came to know Woodward in work that really was whistleblower power. You know, it's those people who were talking to them and protecting their jobs by having anonymity. And now we're talking about people in power who have plenty of opportunities to speak out. Woodward would say yes, but they don't. He has remarkable access, and he does give a picture of power that no one else is giving. But to me, it is a very different thing from daily journalism, in which it is important that we retain the ability to use anonymous sources who are real whistleblowers. But I think we threaten that by conferring anonymity as broadly as he does.
And Michael Massing, I only have a few seconds left. I want to give them to you. Your book, Now They Tell Us, The American Press in Iraq. Does this whole question go to the real issue, which is we didn't learn some of the things that we could have learned about Iraq?
Yes, I have open before me Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, which was about the lead-up to the war in Iraq. And on page 354 to 356, there's a remarkable passage in which he talks about how three separate sources told him confidentially that the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction was not nearly as good as the Bush people were making it out to be. And he wrote a tentative draft of a piece that his editors decided not to go with, and he decided to go along with it. And so this information got buried in the Post before the war, and he himself now says, I was wrong. Knowing what I know now, looking back, I should have worked harder to get this in the paper. And so I would agree with Geneva that too often he is giving these people the benefit of the doubt and not challenging them when they deserve to be.
We're going to have to leave it at that shared opinion. Michael Massing of the New York Review of Books, Geneva Overholzer of the Missouri School of Journalism's Washington Bureau, a topic we will take up with you again. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Waiting for your annual holiday newsletter from Aunt Bessie, letting you know how her 12 cats are doing? Well, author Justin Ratz has just come out with a new book, 50 Relatives Worse Than Yours. It's a field guide to bad family, and it just might give some of your relatives something to laugh about over the holidays. Justin, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
I was looking through the book, and I'm thinking, well, that's pretty funny. And then I got to number 30, Brother Who Beat the Crap Out of You.
Oh, my brother? Yes.
Is this really an older brother of yours?
Yeah, that's me in the photo and my older brother on top of me with his, with his fist cocked. Yes.
And the profile is an older brother who reminds you that you are an uninvited guest in his world, a world of pain that rains down atomic wedgies, noogies, and purple nurples. What's a purple nurple?
A purple nurple is when you grab someone's nipple and you squeeze and turn.
Okay. That's insight into the Raz family, ladies and gentlemen. But where did the inspiration for the book come from?
Well, I mean, this is a sequel to 50 Jobs Worse Than Yours, which was the first book in the series. The next book is 50 Boyfriends Worse Than Yours. The inspiration, it probably came, from the heart, and, from some members of my family. It's not too critical, but I think it's a field guide, but it's also a field good guide that you give to people for the holidays, and they really will feel better about their own families and themselves.
Even if others on the couch might be saying, God, that's just like Aunt Millie or whatever. I'm looking at number 32. It's a huge picture. What you have here is you have the photographs of the categories, the people on the left side of the page, and sort of a profile on the right. And number 32, there's a pair of big red lips with a mustache. It's the Mont, M-A-U-N-T. What's that?
That's half man, half aunt. And, has a little bit of a hair problem, but she's proud. Nothing to hide, no shame.
The motto is, come and give your auntie a kiss, which usually people recoil from. Hey, I'm representing the aunt contingent here. And
I'm an uncle. Sure.
Okay, there you go. What are some of your favorites in here?
I do like mother-in-law. It's actually a photo of my grandmother. And I love my grandmother. However, to my father, her son-in-law, I'm not sure if there was the same amount of love. She is giving a steely, steely glance back to the camera
as if,
watch out.
As you say in the profile, you were not her first-round draft pick. That's the mother-in-law we're speaking of.
Oh, yes, yes. No one's good enough for their child.
Justin, I see in the back of the book there's a thank you, and it's dozens of names here. So are these real people that you know that are pictured throughout the book?
Many of them. Many of them are photos that people sent me, people I met on the web, friends of friends.
There's a picture on page 17. It's sepia-toned. It's of Fanny, not the life of the party. After escaping from the Cossacks in the middle of the night, she hid in the hold of a cargo ship leaving for America. She then settled on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, sold fruit, and resold leather shoes. You got someone like that?
That's my great-great-grandmother, Fanny.
Really?
Yes. In that photo is my mother, her grandfather, and my great-great-grandmother, actually.
So she doesn't like to party much, did Fanny?
I don't think people were allowed to smile in photographs before 1950.
How does your family feel about this?
I think as long as you're in print, they love it. It's a little fame that they can walk into Barnes & Noble and say, hey, I'm in a book, I'm being slammed in a book, but you're still in a book.
We spoke before speaking here on the air, and come to find out, you live in New York, born in New York, but you went to Middlebury College, where you met some of my relatives, oddly enough. And have you noticed they really don't fit in your book? They're just nice people from Vermont. They're just sort of nice. No?
People from Vermont are nice. Lovely people, lovely place.
They, for instance, wouldn't know what to make of your category number 34, the slutty first cousin. Who hasn't had one of those come to Thanksgiving dinner?
My grandmother tried to set me up with my cousin. I'm not kidding.
Justin Raz, his new book is called 50 Relatives Worse Than Yours. Perfect for the coming holidays. Justin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, too.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. With this update on one of the stories we've been following, a federal grand jury in Miami has indicted suspected dirty bomber Jose Padilla for conspiracy to murder, kidnap, and maim people overseas. Since his arrest in 2002, Padilla, an American convert to Islam, has been held in U.S. military custody as an enemy combatant for allegedly plotting to blow up buildings in the U.S. Padilla's lawyers asked the Supreme Court to review his case last month. Legal briefs were due in the case Monday, but today, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said Padilla's Supreme Court case is over.
The relief sought by Mr. Padilla was either to be released or to be charged. And since he has now been charged in a grand jury in Florida, we believe that the petition is moot.
That grand jury also indicted four others, including a Palestinian computer programmer who moved to Florida in 1989 and was arrested in 2002 for overstaying his student visa. He's been called one of the Boston music scene's most unappreciated treasures, but multi-talented musician Chris Brokaw is hoping that will soon change. After playing with the alternative rock bands Come and Codeine, he released the CD Wandering as Water, film scores such as the independent I Was Born But. Now Chris Brokaw returns to rock, but with an acoustic guitar in hand on his new CD, Incredible Love.
I hum the Mexican tune. It swung you all around the room till you turned red and the light outside turned blue, and you'll be out of here tomorrow. But I won't forget about the moon.
That's Blues for the Moon with Chris Brokaw on voice and instruments on his new CD, Incredible Love. And Chris joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks.
I have to go back to that most unappreciated treasure. The accent there is on treasure because you're very appreciated by your many fans.
I feel very lucky to be doing the work that I'm doing.
Well, and especially on this CD when you seem to be doing most of it, Blues for the Moon that we just heard. You played all the instruments?
Yep.
What's your background? Had you studied all of the instruments or picked them up along the way or...?
No, my father was a jazz drummer, so he was always playing music around the house and really kind of introduced me to rock music as well. I started playing guitar when I was 12 and then started playing drums when I was 13.
You mentioned your dad was a jazz drummer. Bebop, I understand?
Yes.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, because in a lot of your music, we hear a lot of influences other than rock.
Yeah.
Why didn't you go into jazz?
You know, I started listening to jazz music about 12 years ago, and I think that after a long time of being really involved in rock and punk rock music, I started getting restless and was introduced first to the music of Charles Mingus, and then I started educating myself from there. And I think part of what I really enjoyed about jazz was that it was a language that I didn't understand. You know, with rock, I could visualize everything that everyone was doing, and with jazz, I had no idea what they were doing. For the last several years, I was really immersing myself in almost entirely in instrumental music. So, you know, it was not a big surprise to me that the first solo record I did, Red Cities, in 2002, was all instrumental.
Well, and that's interesting because your latest CD has a lot of instrumentals on it. But on your new one, you only have one. And I love it. I want to listen to a little of this. It's called Gringa. And as I said, Gringa, the cut we were just listening to, is the only instrumental cut on the new CD, Incredible Love. Your voice is present in every other song.
Mm-hmm.
What does that feel like for you?
It feels really new to me. For a number of years, I've been playing in bands where I was the guy who would sing one or two songs, and there was usually someone else who would do most of the singing. When the Red Cities record came out in 2002, I started doing a lot of touring, playing solo to promote it. And I found myself in a lot of situations just playing mostly instrumentals and singing a couple of songs, and then feeling more and more comfortable with singing and realizing that, you know, when you're playing in a club by yourself, that's another way to really get through to people.
Mm. Well, and it's also a way for you to express the rocker in you. Let's listen to the cut Cranberries.
Why don't we go where the cranberries grow?
That's Cranberries from the new Chris Brokaw CD. It actually probably isn't as hard as you have rocked in the past at all.
Yeah.
But it is a little closer to the rock.
Yeah. It's you know, after a long time of not really listening to much contemporary rock music, I've been getting more into some different punk and metal bands, and it's gotten me really excited about rock music. And I hadn't really been excited about rock music for a long time. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine said to me about 6 months ago, he said, Brokaw, do you think rock is dead? And I said, I don't think it's dead, but I think you have to look for it in different places than you've been looking for it before.
Who do you listen to?
A couple of rock bands, one called Pig Destroyer, another one from here in Boston called Converge. I listen a lot to another guy from around here, a folk player named Chris Smither, who I had the privilege of doing a show with recently.
And it's reflected in your music.
I hope so.
You know, it's as if, you know, a rocker went off to a folk festival and came back, and it's all sort of mixed in together.
I remember the neon nights. I remember the wonderful flights. I remember how free we were.
Many of the songs on Incredible Love, your new CD, including I Remember, mm-hmm. have a nostalgic feel to them. How old are you?
41.
Well, I was going to say, well, you look much younger than that. So, well, 41, you can have nostalgia. But did you as you were making this CD?
No, and people have pointed that out to me. There are definitely certain love or lost love songs on the record. There are also a couple of songs on the record that are thinking really specifically about the war that our country's engaged in right now.
Which one would those be?
Oh, there's a song called The Information Age that's mm-hmm. really about war veterans. And there's another song called Whose Blood that's kind of the way that a lot of people feel, you know, turning on the radio every day and hearing about what's happening in the Middle East.
Singer-songwriter Chris Brokaw, his new CD is called Incredible Love. We'll leave you with some of the music from the CD. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
I just gone missing now when the songs began. From central Kandahar to Jerusalem. Whose blood is singing now? Whose blood will win? Send off a morning song to Jerusalem.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Special thanks today to George Hicks. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.